You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Friday, October 19th, 2018, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Hello, Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Keep going, Bella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hello, Cambridge.
Well, listen, we've been in the UK now for 10 days. This is our second to last event, and it's really been a wild ride. Have you guys been enjoying it?
Absolutely.
It's all right.
Incredible.
It's been incredible.
It's fantastic.
We spent the day getting a tour of Cambridge, and I really had no idea what it was going to be like. I mean, I thought, yeah, okay, it's an old university, but oh my God, it's gorgeous. It's like a medieval, you know, village. You know, it's like Disney World, but good.
And, hey, Disney World is awesome. What are you talking about?
You know, but it's like fully immersive and like real.
It's like Disney World, but real.
But real.
No furry creatures.
You know what's really good? When we talk about wanting a LARP at the location.
Yeah.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
You know what's good, right? Yeah, we talk about that. So we've been to Edinburgh, as Manchester, then Edinburgh, now here. And then, of course, I mean, there's so much going on here in terms of intellectual and scientific history. So this is like literally outside our hotel window. There's a graveyard, right? That's hundreds of years old.
I got to the hotel, and Joss's wife was saying, "Bob, don't look outside yet because it was dark. When you wake up, look outside." So of course I'm thinking, what could it be? So I wake up, I open my eyes, and I see sky. I'm like, well, I don't see anything. So I stood up, and there was not only that, but an ancient graveyard, which of course for me is one of the coolest things ever that I've ever seen out of a hotel window. My God, it was so beautiful.
Well, you know, you're going to end up in one, Beth. So you got that to look forward to.
Well, yeah, I can wait.
So this is a monument to David Hume, right? I mean, the skeptical philosopher is awesome. There's also a statue of David Hume that we saw in the middle of Edinburgh.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went to the Museum of Natural History, which was unbelievable.
Oh, God.
Kara, we were not there at the same time.
We both took
pictures of the same fossil, because this is like both of our favorite fossils.
Yeah, but mine was cooler because my arm was in it.
Yeah.
Cool. Archaeopteryx lithographica. Not the same specimen. I have the Berlin specimen tattooed on my arm. This is actually the type specimen, right? I mean, that's incredible. So that's the first specimen that named the species. And it was also, what did they say, the most expensive thing in the
entire
museum?
The most valuable specimen in the entire museum.
Wait, that was?
Yeah. Yep.
That's it.
And they have some cool stuff in the museum.
Yeah, given all the amazing stuff they have, it's really interesting that. Yeah. But of course, I mean, you know, Archaeopteryx, it's the type specimen. It's an incredibly beautiful fossil.
I find that hard to believe.
What?
Why? Why would they lie?
Look how well preserved it is.
It's their own collection.
I get we're called Skeptic's Guide.
I do think that they are the authority on their own stuff.
I wish I were there with you when the guy tells you that. I'm like, you're full. I don't know what you're talking about.
If it were a guy, I would get you, because, you know, in tour guides, you never know if what they really know what they're talking about. It was on the plaque.
Yeah.
It was there. So this is the most valuable specimen in our collection.
So you believe everything you read, huh?
Yeah.
In that museum? Yeah.
Yeah. All right, Kara, you got to tell us what's going on here.
So I was really lucky. You guys popped in earlier in the day. I had a private collections tour arranged later in the day, and I met up with a couple of London YouTubers, and we went behind the scenes. His name is James McLean, who is the collections manager for Fish, which I was like, that should be weird. But it was actually really cool. And there was this cabinet in the very back that was padlocked in the collection. So this is not open to the public. And we looked in. He said, you know, do you notice anything? I was like, oh, there's a lot of type specimens in here, some holotypes even. So that means it's the only one known, the only known example of that species. And then he had us look a little bit closer at the date, and we realized everything in this cabinet was collected by Darwin himself on the Beagle.
Wow.
Is that incredible? So much of it, too, was in his own handwriting.
So this is why I said, I would think that
there's something in that cabinet that's more valuable, no?
You know, all this is I mean, it's amazing, but it's all relatively recent. I mean, if you think about it, compared to Archaeopteryx, which is, you know, ancient.
It's
an ancient fossil.
The discovery's more recent,
but these were extant species at the time. Yeah. They're not all extant now, but, you know, they're not that old, these organisms.
But Darwin collected those himself and wrote the labels himself.
Darwin collected a lot of stuff, though. It is true. I mean, he actually has quite a big collection. But the interesting thing is there's a lot of things. We think of him as like barnacles and finches, but there's so much more. I mean, he's such an incredible naturalist. He collected, I mean, at the time it was a bit, just kill it and take it, and they didn't really care. Bonk it on its head, throw it in the boat, yeah. But there is a lot of really interesting science.
But what's interesting about Darwin's collection of type specimens on his journey in the Beagle, he was collecting specimens like a creationist, not like an evolutionary biologist. Because, you know,
creation didn't exist back then.
Yeah, that's true.
At that time, they were all creationists.
They were all creationists. True, but it's interesting to look back now because, you know, the type specimen, basically, that defines a species. And so you collect one male, one female, right? But, of course, species have a lot of variation. And an evolutionary biologist today would collect 20. I mean, there's still type specimens that still exist, but, you know, you want to characterize a species, you would collect 20 or 30 specimens at least to characterize the variability within that species, the range. But prior to Darwin, on the Origin of Species, you just needed one, right? Because it was a kind. Everything was created onto its kind. So there's the kind. There it is. And it's just interesting to think that Darwin was acting like a creationist at the time that he was on the Beagle collecting specimens.
Right, because he hadn't published. He was still really struggling with it for several years after he started to. The wheels were turning, and he was making these discoveries. And actually, James McLean, the curator, was saying it's quite difficult with holotypes. When there's only one, you have no idea if it's an aberration, right. You have no idea if it's a juvenile, you have no idea if it's male or female, you don't have other things to compare it to. And sometimes it's not even a new species, it's just, you know, quite a little different from something that's already been collected.
Anyone in the audience a birder? Just give me a little clap.
Birders?
Birders?
Any? People who watch birds?
Oh, okay. Come on, don't be ashamed.
Here we go.
Yeah. All right,
couple. I counted two.
Good. That's twice as many as we usually get.
Because your daughter is apparently not in the audience.
Yeah, she's outside still. So.
Mark them in the book, Jay.
So I ask because, like, if you're a birder, then, like, duh, of course, because you see weirdos all the time. Mm-hmm. And, again, it's, like, really hard to tell sometimes male from female, closely related breeds or species to each other, the juvenile type, the winter versus the summer version. Like, you can't, one specimen of a bird is ridiculous.
And, of course, he knew that because he collected fancy pigeons. Yeah. That was, like, a thing he was into, is different breeds of pigeons and how they looked. So I think those wheels were turning at the time.
Yeah. But maybe he didn't have room.
Yeah.
Like the Ark, you know.
And eventually there's lots of barnacles. A lot of barnacles. Yeah. He's super into those things.
Well, his book after On the Origin of Species was an encyclopedia of barnacles.
Yeah.
Because that, you know, that diving, getting that detailed on one type of creature is important, right? That's like, again, like if you're a birder, you know a lot about birds. It tells you a lot about science in general, categorization, biology. It's really helpful. So, you know, of course, you know, obviously we're all fans of Darwin, we're fans of evolutionary science. So coming to, you know, the home of Darwin is amazing. Of course, at the museum they have a statue of him, and Evan is helpfully pointing out.
There he is.
I've been waiting so long to meet him.
The next specimen I'm showing is a little, like it looks like a little thigh bone, right? Just a little chunk of bone, completely uninteresting in and of itself. But the story behind it is really interesting because the first superintendent of the museum, Owen, collected that specimen and described it. And at least the history says that he was, you know, using his detailed knowledge of anatomy, he was able to predict the type of creature that this came from. And just from that little piece of bone, he said, this is probably a very large flightless bird. And in fact, that bone is from a moa, which had yet to be discovered. Moas were large, flightless birds native to New Zealand, who were wiped out, you know, by people. Like the dodo, right? But I think a little bit before.
And the great auk. Yeah.
Yeah. So to me, that resonated with me because it's quite frequent. If you're into paleontology, there's a lot of stories where, you know, paleontologists discover one little piece of bone, one tooth, you know, or one finger bone or whatever, and then they describe the species that it probably came from. And I never quite bought it, right? Because it always seemed really...
Oh, come on, you bought it.
But I know, but I yes, but I think, all right, that, fine. They're extrapolating, maybe that may be the case. But there are also famous mistakes, like mistaking a pig tooth for a human tooth, because they look very similar. Some of the bones look very similar. Okay. But the fact that he was able to tell that pretty well that that was a large flightless bird does, you know, restore some confidence that they really do know what they're talking about. That when they do make those extrapolations, at least sometimes they could be incredibly correct. You know what I mean?
Sure. I mean, I don't know. It's weird. I wasn't as impressed as you, because to me, that's sure. Of course, they are so they have such expertise that they can extrapolate.
Yeah, but Bob, when you say they, seriously, how many people on the planet could have made that call?
Very few.
Right.
And, yeah, maybe for a bird, but then there's experts in, you know, in primates, hominids, and
right. Yeah, they're all experts. Awesome. What's the point?
I mean, but...
But also, what year was this? What year was this? Like, think about the tools that they're working with. Yeah. They don't have databases to compare. No 3D printing, no CT DNA scanning. Typing. Yeah, I mean, it's incredible. This is all based on how it looks.
Just on anatomical details.
Yeah, maybe he did. Sure. Who here knows who Yukon Cornelius is?
Wow,
that is such a cultural divide.
Never mind.
Steve's wife raised her hand, by the way. we got one here.
Watch when Christmas comes around.
All right, Kara.
Yes.
We came up with this new bit that we're going to test out on this audience.
I'm excited. Okay, so I was looking through my feed reader. You know, we look for science stories constantly, just constantly digging through the news, figuring out what's going on. And I want to share more news stories than we ever have time for. So I decided there would be a fun game that we're going to play where I know the actual headline from the news, and we're going to go down the line, and these guys are going to guess the headline.
Oh.
So what's the first one there? The blank that here with their blank. Mm-mm. What order do we want to go? I'm nervous for Jay here.
Right. I promised Steve I was going to reel myself in on this show.
I know. Are there children in the audience?
Is there a room I could just go into and just scream for a little while? And I'll come back up.
So we'll start with you, Jay.
The bat that could hear with their eyes.
Bob?
The dogs that hear with their noses.
Mm-hmm.
That's not it?
Nope.
Okay. How about the cetaceans that hear with their teeth?
I like how broad. That way, if any cetacean were in the play. No.
The pachyderms that hear with their trunk.
Oh, I like that.
Thanks.
But no, it's actually the butterflies that hear with their wings.
Butterflies that hear with their wings. That makes sense.
It's pretty cool, right?
No one will believe me, but I almost said the bats would hear with their wings.
Yeah, I don't believe you.
So I'm going to give myself a point.
You get 1 point. At first, when you said the bats that hear with their eyes, is that what you said?
Yeah.
I was like, oh, he got here. And then I realized I left that word in. I'm so impressed. Okay, let's try another one. That's an article in The Atlantic by Ed Yong. It's really interesting. Don't have time to explain it. What's the next one? Ooh, the robot economy will run on what?
The robot economy will run on arc reactors.
Is that a thing? Did you make that up?
Science fictional thing.
Oh.
Iron Man. The robot economy will run on bitcoins.
Bitcoin, interesting.
The robot economy will run on credit.
Credit?
Batteries.
Steve, you were really close.
Oh, yeah?
The robot economy will run on blockchain.
Blockchain, same thing.
The technology underlying it. That's an article
blockchain,
in Goblet.
It's the technology underlying cryptocurrency.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. All right, we got another one. Eating the blank blank, I left this one in there, makes naked mole rats better blank.
Eating the unborn pericardium makes naked mole rats better devils.
It's an actual science story. Actually,
these are actual science.
These are all actual news items from like just the past couple days. How about this? Eating the blank blank, we're leaving those, makes naked mole rats better parents.
It's the blank blank that's making this a little more difficult, I think, though.
So maybe it's the umbilical cord sac situation, the afterbirth.
Mm-hmm. Eating the umbilical cord, the placenta?
Eating the placenta, right, the
placenta?
Disgusting placenta.
Got any more votes? We're all eating the disgusting placenta makes naked mole rats better parents.
Disgusting is a scientific term.
No lie, this one is eating the queen's poop.
Wait, which queen?
Yeah, apparently naked mole rats have societies much like honeybees do, and there's a queen and their worker mole rats, and eating the queen's poop, the actual queen mole rat. Some hormones.
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 That's it? Okay.
Yeah, they can't really figure out why, but it seems to have something to do with
hormones.
At that
point, I would just prefer to read a book.
It's fascinating, though. Okay, we've got a few more.
All right.
Scientists catch a rare glimpse of the blank blank.
Big Bang.
Okay. It's a good guess. Rare glimpse of the Big Bang. What else we got? Bob's not having it.
We don't know what kind of scientists, do we?
No. That would help.
That would help a lot. Mm. Yeah. A rare glimpse of the ruddy toehopper.
Is that a bird?
No, I made it up.
I am so gullible around Steve. I don't know why. You can
always
get me. I do
my straight man thing. She buys it every time.
Always gets me.
Hawking radiation? I don't know.
Of the Hawking radiation?
That's why I didn't say it.
But you did
say it. It's pretty good.
That's why I didn't say the.
Of the 2019 budget.
This one is a bit sad, but also exciting. A scientist caught a rare glimpse of the endangered vaquita.
What's that?
This is a porpoise, a very, very endangered, an incredibly threatened porpoise off the coast of California. There are only a few known to be in existence, and there was an observation of them recently, which was exciting. All right, we got two more. Blank's artistic talent was due to a blank eye.
Da Vinci's artistic talent was due to a dead eye.
Van Gogh's artistic talent was due to a lazy eye.
Ah.
Raphael's artistic talent was due to a queer eye.
Can you say that?
Oops.
Sorry. That's so good.
Sorry.
No, that's so good.
I wonder if they interpreted that as the same way we did.
Did we? Yeah, they watch Queer Eye. You guys have Netflix. Come on. What else we got? Is that everybody?
They didn't get, you know, Cornelius, Yukon Cornelius.
That's true, but that's a 50s reference.
I can't follow Evans. It was too good.
Who said Da Vinci?
Me.
Da Vinci?
Holy crap.
His artistic talents. Okay, so first of all, this was in Cosmos magazine, which is an Australian outlet. I don't know if this word does not translate to American English. It was due to a bung eye.
What? B-U-N-G?
What does that mean? Like a bad eye?
Yeah, like a bad eye. Like they were misaligned, apparently.
A lazy eye.
It's actually called...
That's what a lazy eye is.
Yeah, no, it's actually... You did say lazy. Intermittent exotropia.
Yeah, that's a lazy eye.
We were supposed to guess that.
One of them turns outward. No, bung was the word.
So Steve and I basically...
Yeah, you got it.
No, but exo is out.
Yeah, it turns outward. And apparently...
Yeah, it means intermittent. Right.
There's all these interesting things about how he was able, because his eyes were a bit... Woo, he was able to have some really cool symmetry and stuff.
How did he figure that out centuries later?
I don't know. I didn't read it that carefully.
That's not the point.
All right, we've got one more.
Last one.
Here we go. A rare deadly blank disorder... killed a man in blank after he ate a blank.
Okay, well, a rare deadly eating disorder.
Actually, it's after he ate blank. There's no A, you know. Yeah.
Okay.
A rare deadly, eating disorder?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Killed a man in New York after he ate an entire pizza.
That's pretty good. What else we got?
A rare deadly heart disorder killed a man in Africa after he ate nothing.
All right. What else we got?
That'll kill you.
Anybody want to give a guess?
One guess.
Oh, I like that.
Kentucky disorder. Did you say brain? Ding, ding, ding.
Brain disorder.
A rare, deadly brain disorder killed a man in, Steve already got this one, New York.
Okay, cool. Yep. That was a random guess.
After he ate squirrel brains. Yeah, he read the article. Yeah, so this is why you don't want to eat brains, because you'll get prions.
Right.
So he got a variant of Creutzfeldt-Jakob disorder, which is a prion disorder. Wow. Yeah, yeah.
So how quick does it take a long time to kill you?
No.
Is it painful?
No. It's like 18 years, 20
right?
years. Yeah.
It's quite bad, and it's a bit, it's dementia. It's a really nasty thing. Okay, the headline's funnier than the story.
Can they, if they know the guy ate brains and it's happening, is it too late?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll give you the quick one, too, on it, because I've diagnosed patients with this disease. So it's like the worst thing possible for like neurologists to diagnose.
Really?
By the time you... Yeah, so there's a huge latency between exposure and to first symptoms, like years, like it could be 20 years. That's why it's really hard to track down what the exposure was, because it could have been 5, 10, 20 years previously. And then by the time they get their first symptom, there's no treatment for it, so it's too late. And I mean, I've had patients die within 3 weeks of diagnosis. Oh. Average time is about 6 months. Okay. But it's like every day you're worse than the day before. Oh. Like it's just every single system in your brain shuts down one at a time.
Now, what if somebody ate contaminated brains and they went to the doctor the next day and said, I think I ate some contaminated brains?
There's no treatment and you can't cook it out. That's the interesting thing. You cannot cook it out. So even high heat, because it's the only pathogen known that's not caused by a virus, bacteria, protist. It's a misfolded protein.
Right, it's a protein.
It's a protein that then causes kind of a chain reaction.
It causes other proteins to misfold the same way. And then it's like, it's often been described as, like, imagine you have a lily pad on a pond and then it doubles. The number doubles every day, right? So it just simmers along there for a while. But then once it's towards the end, it's, like, really accelerates. It's like
so
a geometric progression.
This is mad cow. This is kudu. This is, you know, there's a lot of different names for different variants of it, but they're all these prion diseases.
And where do you get a squirrel brain to eat in the first place?
In New York, apparently.
Go to Central Park?
Well, he was a hunter, right?
Yeah, he's a 61-year-old hunter in New York.
But who knows what else he was eating?
Right.
I don't know how they tracked it down to a squirrel brain.
Yeah, right?
Maybe he was like, the only brains I had lately were squirrel.
Maybe he only eats squirrel brains.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Squirrel brains are the best brains.
The only brains that he eats.
Yeah.
And he went nuts. Yeah. So.
He had to, you guys. He had to.
You were all thinking it.
Low-hanging fruit. All right.
Waiting to pounce on that one. All right. So we talk a lot on the show about reliability and validity. When we talk about different tests, and I thought it would be a good idea to go through them in some detail, because knowing when we throw out to like, oh yeah, inter-rater reliability or whatever, like what do we really mean by that? And it's a really important concept, especially for a lot of the psychological tests that we cover. So Carrie, you're going to give us a quick primer, or primer as you say.
I say primer, sorry.
Reliability and validity.
Go ahead. And dirty, reliability, validity. So it's important to remember that reliability, when we talk about that, something having reliability, means it gives you the same result over and over and over. It's reliable, right? Just as the word implies. Validity means it actually measures what it's attempting to measure. It's actually giving you the result that you're looking for. So the question is, can something be reliable and not valid? Yes. Can something be valid and not reliable? No. If it's not reliable, it's not going to be valid. There's a lot of different types, though. So you'll hear us talk about test-retest reliability, split-half reliability, inter-rater reliability. Some of them are a little more straightforward, like inter-rater reliability. If multiple people rate your scores, let's say you take a test and I score it, and then you score it, and we give you the same score, that's good inter-rater reliability. Test-retest, you take a test, you come back, you take it later, is your score going to be similar? That's necessary to show that a test is reliable, but of course there's priming effects and learning effects, and there's all sorts of psychological measures to fix that. There's also things like parallel forms, internal consistency, split half. Those are important for coming up with the test. They're less important for taking the test. On the flip side, there's a lot of types of validity. Kind of the cheap, weak one is face validity. Does it look like I measure what it thinks it measures? Okay, it's got good face validity. More importantly, we're looking for construct validity, criterion-related validity, and then there's some more specific types like sampling and formative. And these are all things that does it measure what it says it measures? Right. We can compare it to a different criterion, another test that's also an IQ test. Is my score the same on this IQ test as on that IQ test? Okay, it's probably got good criterion validity, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and one way to think about it, like you could say just, is it measuring something real?
Yes.
Right? That's a good way to conceptualize validity.
Like, if I wanted to see, I take an IQ test and then also take a test of academic achievement. Those two things should correlate.
Right.
If they're not correlating, it might not be a valid
test.
What
are you actually measuring?
Exactly.
Yeah, that gets to the other one in terms of like just a general concept, and that is, does it predict anything? Mm-hmm. And that's mainly the way we figure out if something is valid.
That's something called predictive validity.
Does it have predictive validity? Because that's easy to test. If you have a high IQ, does that predict success in your career, in academics, or anything else, does that come from?
And so some things are very straightforward, right? A math test. Like, does it have predictive validity for, I don't know, your scores in the next math class you take?
Right.
Sorry, maths.
But would you go through reliability first, like when you're making an assessment?
You do it all.
Yeah.
You cannot publish an assessment unless you've gone through all of these.
No, I mean, like in the very early stages, you just work on the reliability
So there are whole textbooks about how to, psychometric textbooks about how to develop a test. And usually in the early stages, you're going to take your questions and you're going to pull them out. You're just going to focus group your questions first before you even get to reliability and validity. You focus group them. And then once you have a pool of test items that you think are appropriate, you're going to test both of those things kind of at the same time.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like, for example, if you consider the diagnostic criteria for ADHD, does that predict anything? Well, yeah, it actually predicts an awful lot about somebody. If you meet the criteria, then you are more likely to get divorced. You are more likely to go to jail. Your earning potential over the course of your life is less. You are more likely to die of physical trauma. There's a lot of things.
Is that all true?
Yeah, that's all true. It really is highly, highly predictive, which tells us that it's probably telling us something real about people. Otherwise, it wouldn't really necessarily predict or correlate with anything.
Unlike the one that's been trending right now about the freaking the ring finger and personality and sexuality.
Or like I always go to astrology. Like, yeah, you could have really elaborate tests for astrology that may even have reliability, inter-rater reliability, although they don't have inter-rater reliability. That's one of the ways you know that astrology is bunk. They do not have two different people will give you completely different readings. But they also don't mean anything. They don't predict anything.
They don't correlate.
They're not valid. There's no validity at all.
But for example, phrenology, right? That's actually quite reliable. If you use the same map and a different person is feeling for bumps and they, okay, there's a pit here, and then they look it up in the book, you might get the same scores over and over and over, but that doesn't mean it's valid.
Right.
Something can be reliable, but not valid.
And one of the most probably important aspects of validity is it plausible, right? Do you have to break the laws? Yeah, do you have to break the laws of physics in order for that thing to exist? That's a good one. So we wanted to do a real-world example of reliability and validity. So we decided that the five of us would take the Harry Potter school sorting test to see if it was, you know, how reliable it was.
Yeah.
Mm. And I think we, so we also, because the, while Kara was looking at Darwin's, you know, type specimens, we were getting a tour of Harry Potter World at Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
Right?
Amazing.
Yeah, that was great.
Woo. I still question my life choices, but
it's called having a family, Steve.
Yeah, I know. We have a picture of us in front of this gorgeous model of Hogwarts. Like the whole thing, it was great.
Have any of you guys seen this?
That was
you come around that corner. It was like breathtaking. You know,
it
like
was.
I've never seen anything like that before.
I mean, it's a lot bigger than it looks in that picture. It's huge, and you can get to walk around the whole thing. It really is just an impressive, you know, work of art.
It took them 40 days to assemble all the pieces after everything was built.
Yeah.
And they have to repaint it every year?
Every two years?
The reveal was amazing. When you're walking up, none of us had any idea that this was coming. And we had just walked past the paper model of the castle, which is like as big as half as this table or so. And then you walk into this monstrosity that was, I mean, after seeing Newton's Principia today with his own handwriting, this is second place after that.
Yeah,
this was just like, it's really an experience.
Since you bring that up, I mean, we didn't mention the fact that we were at the Wren Library. Who here has not been to the Wren Library? Raise your hand.
Oh, wow. My God.
You guys, it's right there.
How easy is it to get in there?
No, it's open like every day from 10 to 2.
You got to go. I mean,
10 to 2.
It's really amazing.
All kidding aside, that was the single most impressive thing we saw on this entire trip, was walking into that room and seeing a first edition of the Principia that was Newton's first edition that he hand-wrote notes in for the second edition.
Right.
And there it is. Or a first edition of Darwin's On the Origin of Species that he had sent to Sedgwick, and it's Sedgwick's like snarky comments back to Darwin written in
on every page. How about the medieval manuscript?
I lost my mind. This from 1230, handwritten and like gilded. I mean, it was stunning.
Unbelievable. Yeah, I mean, that's like, you know, that just blows your mind what they have in there. So please go if you haven't been and you have.
By the way, you might not know this, but in America, we don't have much history.
We have a history of killing Indians.
Thank you for that. We don't have a lot of written history in America, and we don't have
nothing like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's just stunning to see medieval buildings.
Yeah, it blows us away.
Yeah.
I mean, I saw Lord Tennyson's his handwriting, you know, in his own journal,
And he's always been my favorite poet. And I'm like at first I asked my wife, I'm like, do you think my favorite poem is in there? I didn't realize it was like one big collection that he had done. But just being in the presence of something that I have an emotional attachment to, mm-hmm. like that, it's humbling. You just feel like, man, like I'm, you know, you start to shrink in that room. You're like, I am not worthy at all.
It is amazing. All right, so how did everybody do on the Harry Potter test? I'll go first. I think I've taken it the most number of times of anyone here. I took it a few years ago, right? So this is good retest reliability. Mm-hmm. Then I took three different tests in the last few days. Mm-hmm. There's one on Pottermore, which is the one that was put together by J.K. Rowling herself. Mm-hmm. There's the other one that's highly rated, the one that by Time Magazine. And in fact, that one, Kara, right, we found out that is actually being used mm-hmm. as a scientific experiment by somebody here at Cambridge.
Are you
stand
in the
up,
room?
Stand up. Don't be shy.
No, it is cool. You have to, not have to. You can choose to consent for your information because they're using it actually as a personality assessment.
Yeah, and they're trying to gather for the first time regional personality, mm-hmm. like topography, right?
And somehow that's tied into your house. I don't really understand.
So, and then there's another one that's not as good. So I took this four times, and every time I got the same house.
What do you for which one?
Interesting.
What do you guys think my house is? Shout it out. Ravenclaw. Oh, actually, I'm 100% Ravenclaw.
There's criteria for validity right there.
I'm 4 for 4 Ravenclaw.
I think that is the skeptic house.
I think so, too. Yeah. So that's pretty good.
Then why aren't any of us?
Test, retest, or intertest reliability.
Well, what were you?
Yeah, well, I was Hufflefluffy.
Hufflepuff.
Hufflefluffy.
All right, Hufflepuff. Eric, Hufflepuff. Want to admit that you've not read the books or seen the movies?
I've seen half of one movie. I was Hufflepuff.
Yes.
The first time, and then I was Ravenclaw, right?
Ravenclaw.
The second time.
Yeah.
So, Don't know about that.
But the second time was the Time Magazine.
It was a different test.
And they give you a rank, right? So your number two is Hufflepuff.
My number two is Hufflepuff.
Yeah. So that's
Hufflepuff.
Yeah.
It's a fun word to say.
Yeah.
Hufflepuff.
All right. It's not bad.
Yeah. What about you?
Took three tests.
Yeah.
First test, Hufflepuff.
Hufflepuff.
Second test. This is the Pottermore one.
Yeah.
Slytherin.
What? Ooh, that relates to my news item.
Yeah. I'll see you all later. Third one, 43% Hufflepuff, 35% Ravenclaw, 0% Slytherin. That's the Time Magazine one.
I was 0.1% Slytherin.
Yeah. So you were 2 out of 3 Hufflepuff.
Correct.
Okay, so that's more. That's better than random.
2 out of 3 Hufflepuff ain't bad.
Yeah.
What about you, Bob?
Pottermore, I was Slytherin. Which made me happy because I love Halloween. I love creepy stuff. So I was like, all right, that kind of makes sense.
I did it for you. By the way, the questions are like, do you cheat? Yeah, all the time.
No, that's the Time Magazine one. So we should say that the Pottermore test was very abstract. Yeah, it was left or right?
Right, light or dark?
Left or dark? Left is sinister.
No, black and white. It was another one. I love black, so I picked black. I mean, that's
Slytherin. Yeah, but the one like, would you cheat or whatever? Those were the Time Magazine ones.
But all right, so Time Magazine, I was Hufflepuff and 0% Slytherin. So what the hell?
And so both of you were the same flip from Hufflepuff to Slytherin.
We had the same pattern, Bob and I. Yeah.
That's interesting.
Is it though? What about you, Jay?
So what's your beef with Harry Potter?
We can't start this conversation.
You sure you don't want to? Let's have it out in front of them. Okay. So I was Ravenclaw, and then the Time Magazine one, which tells you the percentages, I was like Ravenclaw and then almost Gryffindor.
Yeah. I was Gryffindor number 2 on that one as well. Yeah. So we were very similar. So we had 100% test, inter-rater reliability, if you will, and you guys both flipped, but in the same direction, and you were flipped.
Flippy floppy.
Yeah.
So what do we learn?
You know, I think the test is just as good as the Myers-Briggs.
Yeah.
That's what we
learned.
I think
so, too. Yeah.
What I learned is that the sorting hat, is creepy. Because it is. Because think about it, that thing has, four personalities imbued into it, the four different minds that are in there, and it's basically poking around your head, trying to figure out. Yeah, that's not cool.
Right.
And but it's stupid. It's stupid, too. It's stupid because freaking Voldemort wore that damn thing, and he wasn't like, holy crap, this guy's nuts. Steve, what is happening?
Well, I'll explain it to you later.
Okay, thank you.
But, yeah, so I think Liz, who's along with us, said, it's almost as if there isn't only four personalities in the world.
Yeah.
You know.
Who would have thought?
Who would have thought, yeah. But I do think, it's like any personality test, which I'm not a fan of, I think I've made that clear on the show, any forced choice, like there's three or four or six or eight or whatever personality types, come on, there's way more nuance than that.
But remember, we did cover a recent news item about personality traits, not types.
Traits.
And they did bring it down, I can't remember if it was four or five or six, but one of them was not like anything. It was like...
Yeah, average.
Yeah,
average
personality.
Right.
Yeah, because you can sort it into any number so long as one of them is everybody else.
Yeah, right.
That'll always
right,
work.
Basically. All right, I think we're going to do some news items now. Jay.
Oh.
Yes.
I didn't tell them about what I got to do today here at Cambridge.
What did you get to do today here at Cambridge?
Tell
us.
I got to interview the Astronomer Royal. And I feel so bad because in his book I wrote Sir Martin Rees, and then when I asked him, does Sir supersede Doctor? He said, well, Lord supersedes Sir.
When did that happen?
What do you know?
Who gets to say that?
I know.
So wait a minute,
He needs to update his Wikipedia page, okay?
This guy's an astronomer,
yes.
And now he's a lord.
Yes.
So we could pretty much officially call him Star-Lord.
Yes! Star-Lord
Rees.
I think we should make this catch on. He'd like it.
Let me tell you something.
Yeah.
Yes.
If through any fluke of nature I was given that title,
I would
totally change my name to Vader. To be called Lord Vader legitimately just once in my life would just basically my mind would explode.
But really, he was super cool. Have you guys met him? A few people, yeah. No, he's really, super, really nice, really gracious. I got to go to his office. He made a joke about it. I said, it was so nice of you to let me come to your office here and sit in this beautiful space. And he said it was really nice of Newton to let me use it. Don't know if he meant it, but maybe that was Newton's office. I mean, that's incredible, right?
Yeah, it was.
That's cool.
So cool.
That was one where the phoenix turns around and the stairs go up.
They have to explain these jokes to me. I don't understand
that. I know, when we're recording the show...
Constant.
And she knows that Steve can edit stuff out, she's always like, wait, what was that? What was that? What's that
funny?
Why
am I not
Why is that funny?
And sometimes it's just funny because it sounds funny.
Yeah.
But then later, you're like, you guys are like, you have no idea what we're talking about. You have no idea.
She's picking it up, though. She's getting there.
300!
300!
300! I don't even know what that means anymore. It's just funny to say.
Okay. All right, now, Jay.
Yes.
So I understand that there some an American and a Russian astronaut.
Yes.
Into a bit of a sticky wicket recently.
Sticky wicket.
What's a sticky wicket?
Okay. I don't know. Ask these guys.
Is that like getting into a bit of a
Bit of a pickle. Yeah, that we know.
I guess it was kind of a pickle.
Yeah.
This was really serious. I mean, I'm a fan of space travel, and this both is thrilling to me and pretty horrifying because, you know, we've had, you know, astronaut and cosmonaut deaths in the past and everything. But to have something really bad happen and have them survive so, you know, perfectly, like things went really well. So I'm talking about Nick Hague and the Russian cosmonaut Alexei Ovchinin. It's like I'm just meant to be given words I can't pronounce. Ovchinin. Yes, Ovchinin.
Paraceralophus.
Exactly. Don't even. Come on. Don't. It's embarrassing.
Sorry.
Especially in front of these guys. They know what that is. All right. So the good news is these guys are in very good condition. They literally didn't get a bruise after what they went through, which is pretty amazing. So their Soyuz FG had a mission-ending failure on October 11th, 2018. So the original ascent and orbital insertion was supposed to take 6 hours. So now we're at the two-minute mark. The booster rockets, you see them in this picture. There's four of them. And they're essentially strapped to the core rocket, which is the center rocket. One of them didn't decouple at the two-minute mark, right? So those boosters come off, and that just helps them get up to right on the edge of the atmosphere. And what happened was the one that stayed on, now they still have some fuel in them. And it stayed on, and then because of the aerodynamics at that point, it just kind of pushed right into the main fuselage, and an explosion happened.
Which right there you'd think, game over. How did they survive, right? It's game over. Well, I think this is awesome because they, of course, develop systems. You know, they have these emergency systems in play. So the Soyuz module was flung away violently from the rocket core when this happened. And then the two, the cosmonaut and astronaut that were aboard were flung like violently in their chairs, and they have some video. They didn't give us too much, but you could see like the jarring experience that they had during some of the events, which is cool. They have a little webcam, I guess, in there. And then they were immediately in zero G. Now, these are two hyper-educated individuals who know everything about like the environment that
so they knew something was wrong.
Not only did they know something was wrong, they knew something was wrong before it actually went wrong. Because before everything just kind of shot to, you know, everything went kaplooey, they were feeling something not happening correctly.
Yeah, they knew it was heading towards the fan even before it hit.
Right. But going into zero G was the big, like, ding, like, oh, we're screwed. Then, so right around then, it was only a moment when they were in zero G, the ballistic descent kicked in. Now, this is the launch abort system, which is great. I didn't know much about the launch abort system beforehand. I heard about it, but I didn't really read deeply about it. Well, it's actually pretty nuanced.
It's a good thing to have.
Absolutely. Yeah. This is a lifesaver.
Ballistic, though? That doesn't sound...
Well, no, it is, because they have to re-enter, right? So imagine this. You're 31... Where are they? 31 miles up. That translates into what? I'm sorry. Because you're...
Far?
Yeah. They're on the upper edge of the atmosphere. Almost no atmosphere where they are. They could see outer space. They could see the blackness of outer space. They could see the curvature of the Earth like crazy. You know, they're way up there.
And if you believe that sort of thing.
Yes. Yeah. Wouldn't it be awesome? See, this is where don't ever make me an astronaut. Because I would prank the world. I'd be like, it's flat! Holy shit! You know, like, I would have to do it, and then Steve would kill me.
Right.
So... this ballistic reentry system that they have, Bob, pay attention. I'm answering your question. They have to get back down. And
well, gravity takes care of that pretty easily.
Yeah, but now imagine if they're going up and they're going out at an angle, and you don't want them to kind of reflect off of or bounce off of the atmosphere.
The ballistic descent means that they're going at a steep angle.
Oh no, that's right. It's the angle.
Yeah,
we couldn't answer a couple of questions, so we had to do more research.
We figured it out.
But check this out. The real thing is that they're falling without any atmosphere to slow them down. So they're going crazy fast. I believe at their top speed, 4,000 miles per hour or 6,437 kilometers per hour.
Whoa. So the ballistic descent is distinguished from a controlled descent.
Right.
A controlled descent is a shallow angle so that they will decelerate at a reasonable rate.
Right, so the space shuttle does that.
Yeah. And that's what they're supposed to do. When the capsule's coming back in, they should be at a shallow angle so that they decelerate slowly, you know, at 1 or 2 Gs. A ballistic descent is a steep angle, and they decelerate way before they deploy the parachutes. They decelerate very quickly because they're hitting hard atmosphere at a very rapid speed.
And that's when they hit. That's when they got 7 Gs.
Seven Gs.
Yeah, six.
Seven
I think it was 6.7 Gs. And the problem is, it wasn't. It was for an extended period of time.
It was a long time of 7 Gs.
Did they? I mean, did they all? Did they lose?
No, they didn't, because they're in their suits. And not only did they not pass out. Well, remember, their suits are giving them, these are the pressure suits, which means that their blood isn't pooling in whatever is the lowest thing. Yeah.
Squeezes the legs and the arms, keeps the blood in the torso and the head.
I mean, fighter pilots experience 8 to 10 Gs all the time.
Yeah, briefly, though.
Yeah, briefly. Right.
Yeah, not
this was sustained.
Yeah, if you have a sustained, if you have a sustained 10 Gs, that can kill you. Yeah.
For like a minute or two, you're dead.
Yeah. And your blood, there's also this weird thing that your blood can do. You ever hear about this? It's like, I forget the term, but your blood will do something very strange under zero Gs. It pools up, and like you have all of your blood in your body pretty much
zero G.
pool in your head,
which
will make you go unconscious as well. So this is really dangerous. So while all of this is happening, guys,
So this is their plan to save them, to experience 6 or 7 Gs. That's the safety plan.
Yes.
They had no choice at that point.
And there's no save game, right?
No save game. Yeah, right.
Wait, what is... that means
you save your game.
Oh, save game. Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah, like you ever play Kerbal Space? You know the Kerbal Space thing, which is so much fun. You know, you could save your game. So anyway, so during those extreme forces, they had to complete a to-do list.
Yeah,
like a checklist.
Yes, they have a checklist. So they have
number one, scream your head off. Number two,
kiss your ass goodbye.
Your pants.
So they had to check the vehicle's orientation and response continuously because they're monitoring the vehicle to make sure that everything is cool.
How? They're going 4,000 miles an hour? Yeah. Like, oh my God.
They had to ensure that the valves were working properly on the ship because I guess, you know, the valves have something to do with the... Because that ship has an engine on it as well. There's still an engine on it.
Could they lift their arms?
It'd be hard.
Yeah, right? Wouldn't you feel...
I honestly don't know.
No, it's actual gravity, right? It's like the gravitron at the circuit. I don't know. And that's centripetal, but it pushes you against the wall. It's that same kind of feeling.
Well, yeah. I mean, they orient the capsule with the heat shield, right? And so it would be exactly as if they were in a 7G gravitational field.
Yeah, so they're being pushed into their seats. Yes. Well, I guess their arms would weigh
seven times as much. It'd be really hard.
But I guess they have to, though, because they were doing stuff. And then they have to communicate with the rest. So they were communicating with the ground the whole time, which I think, that's commendable. I mean, these guys stayed conscious and were, like, completely keeping their cool.
I mean, there's an audio recording somewhere of this. I hope they release that someday.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll see more stuff. I mean, you know, who knows what Russia's going to do? I would love to see the whole thing.
Also, who knows what they were, like, screaming at the top of their lungs right at the beginning. Maybe they weren't.
I'm sure that when it first happened.
Yeah, they must have had a moment, right?
Of
they
course.
Are human.
Yeah, they probably said, oh, shit, rather than scream.
Yeah, there you go.
But, neither of these guys are Kirk, okay? But anyway.
But they totally leveled up after this landing.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Oh, hell yeah.
Achievement unlocked.
So
they got like double experience points for that.
So then, they come down. So they were 50 kilometers up, 31 miles up when the whole thing started.
Yeah.
So 30-minute descent. Then the chutes open. And they brace themselves because when the chutes open, it's this big, like this huge jarring thing that they had to deal with. Which I guess at that point, that's nothing compared to what they went through. You know, then their capsule hits the ground. And the two of them immediately are shaking
they
each other's hand. No, no, they landed on ground. But they, they were like laughing through relief. Could you imagine the bonding that would happen during an experience like that? So let me give you a couple more cool facts. All of the Soyuz missions, they had 22 failures in total. They've had 765 successes with 786 total launches.
How many?
786 total launches. And the first flight happened in 1973. So, they've been iterating this series of rockets. Very, very, very high, like 97% success rate here, which is fantastic. But the fact that their emergency system completely saved these people's lives, like, you don't hear that. Has it happened? Like, how many lives have been saved? It's not a common thing that people survive
The shuttle, we didn't have one, right? No emergency, abort system. They talked about putting one in after the Challenger.
Yeah.
But I don't know that they ever did before they retired it. But now the big question now is, I don't. Yeah, I think they put something in, but it was never used.
They had like an escape hatch.
Yeah.
You screwed.
Yeah. You know what I mean? You go first.
I understand they're saying that the International Space Station is not being threatened; that they will be able to get another capsule up there.
Do they know what happened?
Yeah, they do. I mean, look, this is what the information is being released, but if you were paying attention about 7.5 minutes ago, I said... Now, Bob, you see the four booster rockets? One of these are only strapped on. One of the straps didn't let the rocket go, and it tipped in.
Right, I understand that. Like, what caused that to happen?
Faulty straps.
So strap maintenance.
Yes, they need to do more strap maintenance.
There's a strap failure.
Yes. I had one more point, and Bob killed it. I had a cool thing to say.
You do that to me sometimes, too,
Oh, I got it. I know. The Russians said that they want to do 3 unmanned flights before they'll let people go back up. Of course, they're going to figure out exactly what went wrong and fix it. On what?
Uncrewed.
What did I say?
Uncrewed.
That's the 1960s of your day.
Right.
No, it's quite a new... The frustration with crude is that it sounds like crude, right?
Yeah.
It's like we got to come up with something better. Because when it's written, it's quite nice.
Unstaffed?
That's a little too late.
The NASA...
Like janitors?
NASA does use crude. I mean, that's like
uncrewed.
The standard. Right, yeah.
But unhuman.
Unhuman. Yeah. That gets the job done. Not very poetic. All right. All right, but they're alive and the program is good, and that's good.
They survived.
Yeah, I know.
It's great. That's right. Yeah. It's better than
happy
good.
Ending.
All right, this is a really neat news item, which has the extra. I did not pick this news item because
it picked you.
The astronomer. No. A good news item, like a good wand, picks you. But But it just so happens, by pure coincidence, that the astronomer working on this, who published this paper, actually is here, from here, Cambridge, Kathy Clark. Kathy? Could be in the audience. Who
Kathy
knows?
Clark?
Kathy? Anyone? Kathy? No.
All right. Anyone know Kathy?
This is an exoplanet news item because there's an exoplanet research center at Cambridge, and they're discovering a lot of cool stuff. So this is a C tau C I C I C or Psi?
C, how's it spelled?
C I. I don't know. So we'll call it C tau for now. A little while ago, they discovered a hot Jupiter around C tau, which would be C tau B.
What's right? A hot Jupiter?
It's very close to
yeah. Appearance. A hot Jupiter is exactly what it sounds like. It's a Jovian-sized planet, so it's a gas giant about as big as Jupiter. And it's hot because it's really close to its parent star. In this case, it's about 0.1 AU, about a tenth the distance that the Earth is from our sun.
The idea is that it forms in the outer solar system and then migrates into the inner solar system, and that's how it got so close.
Well, that is a point of active disagreement. Yeah, yeah. So astronomers disagree about whether or not hot Jupiters form in situ, meaning where they are, very, very close into their star, or they form far out and then migrate in.
And well, think about it. I mean, how is it going to form close to the star? I mean, you need the cold outer reaches of the solar system for all that gas to accumulate. First you have a rocky core, yeah. Then the gas accumulating. The gas is going to accumulate close to the star itself.
That's why they think it may be forming far outside and coming in.
So it has a rocky core.
No, we don't know. We don't know. All we know is that it's a gas giant.
Well, all good fighters have a rocky core.
Yeah.
We could have our Jovians. Our Jovians have a solid core.
Steve, can when a Jovian planet goes in that close to the star, can it actually ignite?
No, it needs mass for that. So the reason why this is important, if we're thinking about like what does the solar system, that this stellar system look like, if there's hot Jupiters migrate in, they probably kick out all the inner planets on their way in, right? So we're not going to expect to see a lot of Earth-like planets around a star that has a hot Jupiter if it migrates in from the outside. So I was very disappointed when I first heard that, because if there's a lot of systems with hot Jupiters, that really reduces the number of possible systems that have Earth-like planets on it.
But maybe it has a moon.
And it's probably too close to have a moon. There's a limit of how close you could be to your star and still have a moon. So, but here's the thing. Hot Jupiters are really easy to find because they're big and close to their star. So we knew that we were probably, they were way overrepresented among the exoplanets that we found so far. And we had to do more and more surveys to get a good idea of how many there really are. And the current estimate is that about 1% of systems have a hot Jupiter. So who cares, right? So it's only 1% anyway now. So it's probably not a big deal either way.
Do we find them through spec? Do we find them through transit? Do they themselves glow?
So
transit for sure, because that's ideal. Think about it. You've got a big Jovian really close to the star, so it's going to occlude that star very nicely, very easily detectable. Yeah, so there's that. And the gravitational...
The wobble effect
will also be very pronounced.
So far, this is like a big so what. Like,
yeah, so I haven't even gotten to the news item yet.
We're doing background.
This is all background, Jay.
This is all pillow talk.
Absolutely. So here's the actual news item. So now they discovered three more Jovian planets in the same system. Mm-hmm. So this is the first system with four. They haven't been confirmed, but candidate Jovian planets. One of which is a hot Jupiter. The others are too far out. But the other thing that's interesting about this system is the difference between the orbits, because they differ by a factor of 1,000. So you have from 0.1 to 100 AUs. Again, an AU is the average distance between the Earth and the Sun. So one's way out there, one's very close, the other two are in the middle. But that's not the coolest thing about this news item. So yes, this is a very interesting system. There's two other bits of information these are the awesome bits. One is this system is only 2 million years old, which is a baby. It's
a baby stellar system.
So there's still a protoplanetary disk of dust and ice around it. It hasn't been cleared away yet.
So that's what the vinyl record looks like.
That's what we're seeing on the picture.
Like.
We're seeing the disk of dust and ice, and then we're seeing these cleared out bands within the disk. And Clark argues in her paper that The best explanation for that's what was actually imaged, was we didn't actually see the planets. We didn't see their transit or we didn't see the wobble. We just saw the gaps in the disk. And she argues that the best explanation that is that there are large, you know, Jovian planets clearing out the debris in that orbit. And that makes sense. So this is like a new method for identifying candidate planets, which is cool.
So when you say clearing out, are they kicking it away or are they absorbing it?
They're probably absorbing it. Probably both, but they're probably absorbing it.
And is that what's going to happen to the rest of this material?
Eventually, protoplanetary disks, eventually everything, they form together to form asteroids, moons, planets, planetoids, etc. You know, eventually they collide or they get kicked out, you know, and then the system will become progressively cleared until you have something like our system, which has lots of asteroids, right? There's lots of stuff flinging
around.
But
everything's coalesced.
But it's not right. Dust, right?
It's only 2 million years old. I mean, we're talking billions of years.
So you have a hot Jupiter in a 2-million-year-old system. It formed in situ. It did not have time to migrate in from the outside. And there also, you wouldn't have this clean disk system, right? Because if it was migrating in, it would have absorbed everything along the way. So this at least is one system where it probably formed in place and did not migrate in. So that's interesting.
Wow.
The method of seeing the planets is interesting, and this young age of the system is interesting. Now, it was imaged with the ALMA, which is the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array. So it's visualizing in the millimeter frequency range of the spectrum, right? And this was using the Atacama Array, which is 66 radio telescopes using interferometry, right? So you know if you have more than one radio telescope, you can use interferometry in order to make them behave as if they're one giant dish.
Right.
You don't have the same resolution if you actually had one giant dish or the same precision, but you do get the resolution. So this was the finest detail that you could visualize this system. And so that's, again, usually in astronomy, especially with the advance of technology, when we cover stories like this, oftentimes, as interesting as the discovery is the method used to make the discovery. And so we should expect a lot of things to be coming out of this radio array. This is just a really fantastic tool. So now what they have to do is look at this system with other methods to see if we can verify these four Jovian planets. You can't use the transit method because, as you know, it's not edge-on, it's facing us. Mm-hmm. But you can probably use the wobble method.
Right.
That'll be hard for the one that's at 100 AUs, but the closer-in ones, perhaps.
Before you go, I think somebody mentioned, it may have been me, a rocky core. Jovians don't have rocky cores as far as we can tell. Like, we believe Jupiter has probably solid hydrogen.
Yeah.
So not rocky.
So it's not rocky.
Right. Just throwing that out there.
It's hard to tell.
Before we get a million emails.
All right, Bob.
Oh boy.
That is, we are looking at a picture of the Large Hadron Collider.
Right.
So I'm assuming that your news item has something to do.
A little bit.
Can't help but laugh now. Thinking about the most common typo when people write the Large Hadron Collider.
Yeah. You can
fill it in.
Yeah. Figure it out.
It's another fill in the blank.
Are you guys done?
Yep.
Okay.
Sorry, Bob.
So, scientists working for the LHC, or specifically the Large Hadron Collider Beauty Collaboration, LHCb, have reported recently that they discovered two new particles, never before seen, two new particles, and possibly they've seen hints of a third particle. So if you love particle physics like I do, if you listen to the show, I mention it as often as I can, I can't help but do a little happy dance when they discover a new particle. But it's like each new particle is like a new puzzle. And a new piece to the puzzle. And who knows what kind of insights we'll get in the universe as we fill in this puzzle with more and more particles. So what did they find? They found two new baryons. I'm sure there's a lot of people here that know what baryons are, but I'm going to talk about them in detail anyway. So look around this beautiful room. Everything you see here is pretty much everything. Almost everything are baryons. Baryons are not fundamental.
Are photons baryons?
No.
So then everything we see is not a baryon.
I said that. That's why I said most. Most.
No, but everything we see is photons.
Okay.
So I don't think it works.
As I was saying, so baryons are not fundamental particles. They're composite particles. Yeah. They consist of three quarks. Quarks are, as far as we could tell, and we're pretty sure that they are fundamental particles. up, down, top, bottom, charm, and strange. So the most iconic baryons, protons, and neutrons. So if you look at them and you try to determine what kind of quarks are in there, the protons have two up and one down, and the neutron has one up and two down. So the new baryons that they found are a little bit different. Their name was Sigma B 6097 plus and minus. The 6097 is the mass in mega electron volts. So if you look at the quarks that comprise them, they are two up, one bottom, and two down, one bottom. And because of that, it's no surprise that they're called bottom baryons. You can think of them as pretty much heavy protons. They have about six times the mass as protons. So it's interesting. You try to say, all right, well, how confident? I mean, you know, they're kind of seeing this indirectly. They're looking at debris from collisions. How confident are they? And
it's like the MOA boat.
Right. Well, this is even more confident. Okay. So in particle physics, when it's generally accepted that you could say, I discovered something new, if you have what's called the five sigma confidence level, standard deviations. So, and for five sigma, that there's a one chance in 3.5 million that your discovery was just by chance. So that's a pretty good standard, right? 1 in 3.5 million, that's five sigma. These are over 12 sigma. Now, I actually tried to look up what are the odds of that this is just by chance, and I couldn't even find it. If you look at a lot of charts, once you get to 6 and 7 sigma, they say they get a little lazy and they say there's a 0% chance that this is chance.
Effectively zero.
Right.
So why even go for the? I mean, after you get to that point, who's the fool that goes to 8 sigma?
Well, because it is quite different, right? In particle physics than it would be. Let's say Bob and I were talking about this, and in psychology and social science research, we don't even use sigma. Not commonly, although there has been some conversation
because it's pointless
about using it in medicine. Yeah, because we're talking about variation in people.
Yeah, you get to five sigma and nothing.
Yeah, come on. Yeah, but think about how many of these things, when you smash them together, are produced.
Yeah.
So
right.
if it's, you know, by chance alone, and you're talking about millions or hundreds of millions, we have to know that.
If you could look at millions and billions of human interactions, maybe you can start getting some high sigmas.
But they're saying that the chance is zero at 6 and 7.
No, but they're just kind of rounding down a little bit, you know?
It's because there's so many decimal places.
Right, so I didn't calculate it, but it was probably something like 1 in trillions or quadrillions. I mean, it's the confidence level is incredibly high, so
I'll tell you what, Bob, sigma 6 is good enough for me.
Okay, well, this is sigma 12, so it's even gooder
extra
for you, Jay.
Good enough for him.
So that was their main discovery. The other discovery that they made was interesting was a discovery. Now this was a hint. This was a hint at a tetraquark, and that's a composite particle of four quarks. So it'd be for example, two up and two anti up quarks. So that's kind of
those aren't down,
huh?
Anti up or aren't down?
Well, I don't know. No, you can have anti quarks.
Anyone in the house know?
Yeah, they're anti quarks.
They're not.
They're not down.
That, he knows.
Okay,
he says you're right.
This
is the one place where we can just like ask that question.
I know. Right?
Isn't that awesome.
So cool.
But this discovery was only at 3 sigma, so that's 99.7%, which sounds really good, right? But it's not. So there's 3 in 1,000 that would be wrong. Not good enough. So I like this kind of discovery because if they get this up to 5 sigma, that really would be an amazing discovery.
This
the first confirmed tetraquark, which hasn't been made. But I think they're eventually going to find it. A lot of theories are saying that, this looks really, really theoretically possible, and they're predicting that they're going to find it, you know, within a few years. So I think they will.
Are these stable particles, or are they, like, lasting for a microsecond?
No, but they are. I think they're much more stable than previously discovered. I'm not 100% sure, but they were talking about these being more stable.
Why is this cool? Like, really, what this tetra quark thing, why is this something that is an exciting discovery?
For me, it's exciting and disappointing at the same time. It's exciting because it's new information, it's new particles. Who knows? And as you know, with scientific discovery, you never know what's going to come from this. And like I said earlier, the more pieces we fill in, the more particles we discover, who knows what kind of insight. So in terms of just the joy of discovery, right now, that's what it's all about.
But were they theorized? Like, are they responsible for any sort of phenomenon?
That's actually a really good point, because these were theorized. The standard model predicts them.
These are within the standard model.
The quark model predicts them, and that's what makes it a little bit disappointing to me, because what we're doing now with the LHC is we're filling in the standard model. We're finding things that have been theorized, that have been predicted. And that's great and all, but right now, after the Higgs was discovered in 2012 or confirmed, after that, for me anyway, my big hope was that they were going to break new ground with physics. Because the standard model, it has to do with particles and their interactions, but there's a lot of things the standard model does not cover. Dark matter, gravitation, the origin of mass, neutrino oscillations. There's lots of areas that the standard model does not cover. And this is my hopes for the Large Hadron Collider, that they're going to give us some insight into these areas that we don't have any clues about. And how about something really fascinating, like information about new dimensions, some new, brand new physics? Because what's really scary to me right now for the LHC is that they're in a energy domain that we may need to build a machine that's far more powerful in order to break new ground with physics. I'm worried that they're going to be in an area now that's kind of like a desert of new groundbreaking discoveries. I mean, they're always going to make new discoveries, but I'm talking about new physics.
Right.
I hope we don't need another $1 trillion to build a device to do that.
Probably will. But so when they discover a particle that they knew existed because it's within the standard model, it's still helpful because then they can actually measure things like its charge and its mass or whatever. And that helps them tweak the math and the predictions in the standard model. But if they find something that breaks the standard model, that's pointing towards new physics.
Exactly.
That's what we really want, is something that's going to break the standard model. We haven't discovered that.
Right, and that reminds me of the expression, new discoveries aren't generally followed by eureka. They're followed by, that's strange. And then you go, and then you have new questions that you answer. And that's what I really want, is new physics. And hopefully the LHC can still do that. And either way, they're doing great work, even if they don't break new ground.
All right, let's move on to some real science.
Yeah, hard science.
Evan.
Yep.
Now, have we yet proven that we are being visited by aliens from other civilizations?
Well, Steve, the evidence is coming soon.
Soon.
We are promised. We are promised it is coming. Do you know why? Because a fellow who used to work for the Department of Defense is telling us so.
Mm-hmm. Well, there you go.
The United States Department of Defense. I mean, you know, that's the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines. That's it. I mean,
everyone there is a skeptic.
So a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Intelligence is among a group of intelligence specialists, I kind of doubt that, which have recently come forward to claim that evidence for extraterrestrial craft is authentic. It actually does exist. Now, this announcement comes in concert, this is the news item just last week, comes in concert with the official launch of an organization called To the Stars Academy of Arts and Science. And they are self-described as such: a powerful vehicle for change by creating a consortium among science, aerospace, and entertainment that will work collectively to allow gifted researchers the freedom to explore exotic science and technologies with the infrastructure and resources to rapidly transition them to products that can change the world. Right, Jeff?
Wait, transition them to products?
Yes, actual
that
products.
That came out of left field.
No, what came out of left field was the phrase exotic science.
Exotic science.
What's exotic science? Aliens?
Yes.
That's right.
Pseudoscience.
Alien tech, yeah.
Yeah.
You always got to be suspicious of those kind of words, modifying science.
Yeah. You know, like are they saying, like, look, we're on the hunt for aliens so we could steal their technology and turn it into products?
Yes. That's right. Because what they're saying, Jay, is that the Department of Defense has the evidence, and the evidence is about to come forth because of this particular individual who worked for the Department of Defense, no longer works there. He's resigned all his positions. He has a litany of credentials within the U.S. government. His name is Luis Elizondo. And he resigned from all of his government positions, apparently in order to become part of the organization as the sort of liaison between this private organization and the government, because he's very well respected, apparently, through all the branches of government and whatnot. And he is put in charge of the group's community of interest arm of the group. Now, Luis Elizondo, this name is familiar to me. I'm reading through the article. I'm doing some research on it. I know this name somewhere. So I go back into my files, December 20, 2017. We've actually talked about this particular gentleman before. Let's see. Let's go to this. Yes, the New York Times and Politico independently published stories confirming that the U.S. government had quietly funded a program to study UFOs
for years. It was called the Advanced Aviation Threat Identification Program, and this guy was in charge of it, and we talked about this back in December of last year. A collection of video and audio recordings of reported UFO incidents, and the footage includes one of an undated encounter with an aircraft surrounded by some sort of glowing aura, blah, blah, blah. In any case, this particular program was funded and it was by the pushing of Harry Reid at the time. It was a senator from Nevada, and they pumped $22 million into this particular program.
God, what a waste.
And this fellow, Luis Elizondo, was responsible for the oversight. Now, the money itself went to an organization called Bigelow Airspace. Oh, Robert Bigelow, real estate billionaire and strong UFO and alien visitation proponent. Mm-hmm. So his group is going to be in charge of this money, $22 million of our taxpayer money. Let's see, Robert Bigelow, let's look into his background a little bit. He purchased a supposedly haunted ranch in Utah, which some describe as a hyper-dimensional portal area or Stargate. The ranch is said to be infested by an alien or paranormal shape-shifting creature known as a skinwalker.
So we have alien shape-shifting goats?
Yes.
Ghosts?
Ghosts, yes.
Goats. That's a...
Goat ghosts, yes.
That's a supernatural trifecta.
Yeah. You hit the whole enchilada here. Then this guy is also into crop circles, cryptozoology, and other things. $22 million, thank you very much. Gone. This guy, this project is a total crank. This is insane. Yeah. And it's also, when we were talking about, Karen and I were talking about this the other day, who's our friend who used to be the lead singer of the group Blink 182? Anyone ever hear of that rock group?
He's cuckoo
name?
For Cocoa Puffs, that guy.
And he is also very much putting his celebrity behind this particular association to the Stars Academy of Arts and Science.
Weren't you saying that Tom was quitting the band to like...
He did quit the band. To he's just doing this...
Do this full time.
And then he went bankrupt doing it, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. He's got like some
30... Not a lot of money in that.
So the alien tech didn't work out?
Not yet.
Nope, did not work out.
But what's interesting is that I've been hearing, not this specifically, but things like this for 40 years, right?
Oh, yeah.
That it's just around the corner. The government knows. They're going to release it. You know, we're going to be doing this, right? Then you're in this loop. It's endlessly, but you never see any evidence. Ever.
Right.
But then if you ask for evidence, they might say, well, look at the development of computer technology and technology in general over the years, which is so ridiculous because you could trace the beginnings of the technology way back. You know, it's not like you had this moment where like, whoa, we just leaped ahead four generations.
There's no discontinuity.
Right. Are they saying that we had an infusion of alien technology already?
Have you never seen ancient aliens?
Yeah. No, that, some make that claim. All right. Evan, do you think this guy's a psychopath?
Oh, boy. I don't think I'm qualified
That's
to
the right
say
answer.
That.
That's the right
Thank
answer.
Thank you.
Good segue. See what you did there? See what you did there?
Kara has some expertise in this.
New research report in the Journal of Applied Psychology called, no lie, the title, Shall We Serve the Dark Lords? I love psychology papers. They have such creative titles. A meta-analytic review of psychopathy and leadership, right? Because I think that there's an increasing interest in understanding psychopathy at sort of psychopathy in the boardroom, psychopathy in the C-suite, as we call it, C-level, CEO type careers. So I think we often think of kind of the stereotype of a psychopath as somebody who commits crimes, somebody who commits murder, but as we well know, psychopathy does not go hand in hand with violence, and there are many among us. Actually, before I tell the news story, I have to tell you a quick story about... Yes. Have you guys heard of the Story Collider? It's a science podcast. They're actually these live science shows, and it's quite difficult. You have to memorize it. They don't let you use notes. So I did one, and I was really stressed out about it. Don't think I did that well because it never made it to air. But another gentleman who was on the event with me, so it's three or four different people do a live show, and it's generally a personal story related to science. And he was telling the story. He was a psychopathy researcher, a neuropsychologist. He'd been studying it for years. And he was doing an fMRI study, a brain imaging study, and he had a stack of his psychopathy subjects, and he needed controls. And so neurotypical brains. So get some friends and family. We're low on control. So he asked some friends and family to come in and scan their brain. His assistant brought in the envelopes, and he was like, ha ha, so funny, switching one of the psychopaths into the control pile. He's like, no, that was a control. And so he's like, ugh. So they unblinded the study because he was like, you know, ethically, I need to tell them what's going on. Turns out it was him. Can you imagine his entire life studying the phenomenon of psychopathy? Told his wife, she said, not surprised. Actually happened.
So what, I mean, what does that mean, though? Like, what, well, that's what we're going to talk
so
about.
So yeah, it does seem like there's a lot of early evidence that your early upbringing has quite a bit to do with the outcomes, with kind of violence versus nonviolence. But there's also, I think, been a stereotype lately, you know, post-Enron, post-Theranos, of individuals kind of in these positions of power. They must all be psychopaths. And what does it mean to be a psychopath? There's a lot of different ways that you can split that. There are brain scans that you can do, and you see that there's kind of lower activation in certain areas like the amygdala, sort of the, you know, they poke the amygdala and the cat in the hair stands up. It's a bit responsible for things like fear response and a quick anger response. A medial prefrontal cortex, which is really implicated in a lot of social psychology. And there are different traits that researchers have found that are associated, like lack of empathy, impulsivity, boldness. Those tend to be the three big ones, kind of meanness or lack of empathy, boldness, and impulsivity, quick to make decisions. And so the question that researchers have is, okay, I'm looking at this data and I'm thinking, some of it shows that more psychopaths are in positions of power in corporations. Some of it shows that there's kind of a not as much of an issue as we think. Why don't we do a meta-analysis? So they're like, let's look at all the studies that have ever been published that have data in them about psychopathy and also leadership qualities. And they went through all these different studies. They had to throw a bunch of them out, but eventually they landed on 92 independent samples. They looked at these 92 independent samples and they found a weak but positive correlation for psychopathic tendencies and something called leadership emergence. So here we're talking about whether or not somebody becomes a leader. They emerge into a leadership position. Yes, there is a positive correlation between psychopathy and that, but it is quite weak. Right. So it's a bit not surprising, right? Like, we've been thinking that, okay, it's not surprising.
That explains a lot of, like, my business, you know, my whole life dealing with my managers.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
But here's the interesting thing, because you use the word manager, and I think this is quite important, because following that, they actually found a weak negative association for psychopathic tendencies and leadership effectiveness. Kind of makes sense.
You're more
right?
likely to become a boss, and you're a bad boss.
And you're a bad boss. Yeah. Mostly because people don't like you very much.
Yeah.
So you're probably not too nice to them. Yeah, because you're an asshole. That's a way to put it out there clearly. But then they decided, let's look at some of these moderating factors. I want to know what happens if we divide our samples into women and men. Mm-hmm. Because there's a lot of conversation about psychopathy, kind of classical psychopathy, maybe DSM diagnoses of antisocial personality disorder, being holistic, right? This is a big problem in social science research, medical research just in general. Eh, we'll test all the men and then we'll say it applies to the women. But now we're realizing we should probably look at both genders. And they're realizing that maybe female psychopathy actually is quite different than male psychopathy. Maybe, for example, some previous studies have shown that some of the features of boldness and assertiveness come out more in the home with females and more in public with males, for example. With women and men, sorry, females and males, that's a weird way to put it. So then they started to say, let's actually look at the differences. And they found some interesting things. For example, there were some critical gender differences. Men with psychopathic tendencies were more likely to become leaders and were rated as more effective leaders than women with psychopathic tendencies. Women were less likely to be selective as leaders, and when they were selected, they were rated as less effective. So it does seem to be the case that a kind of jerky man might be more likely to get into this position than a woman. So it may actually, women who are often, I think, socially sort of trained to act like men in these situations might kind of bite them in the ass, and it's less effective for them.
But also, averaging out the two sexes dilutes the effect. So
absolutely.
It looks like a weak effect, but it's actually strong.
It's actually much stronger when you section out the women and the men. It's also a bit curvilinear, which is quite weird. So at the low levels and the highest levels, you actually see a weaker effect. At the medium levels of psychopathy, that you see a stronger effect, which kind of makes sense, right? At a low level of psychopathy, you might be passing more off as kind of a non-psychopath. Yeah. At a very, very high level, you're like, ooh, that guy. And it probably actually really affects your interpersonal skills as well. The interesting thing that I found in here, which makes perfect sense, we're talking about it today when we're coming up to Cambridge from London, many people with psychopathy actually rate kind of in therapeutic sessions or as we're talking about with these psychological measures as having no psychopathology. Mm-hmm. Because A, they know how to game the tests, but B, they're not very sensitive to emotional outbursts or emotional difficulty. And many times people go to therapy because they're overwhelmed with emotional problems, right? Whether we're talking about anxiety, depression, most of these issues. So people with psychopathy are less likely to seek therapy, and even when they do, they pass off as neurotypical because it's like, oh, that person's got their, really got it together. Nope.
That's freaking perfect, huh?
It's interesting, right? Yeah. I know.
And all these people that really need and could benefit from therapy would kind of pass the sniff test, you know? I also wonder, this is not pure speculation, if there is a reason that, like an evolutionarily adaptive reason why we persist to have this consistent but low level, like 1% of people basically are psychopaths or would score enough on the test to be rated that way. Right? So you think that there might be some benefit.
Yeah, is there an adaptive?
Yeah.
But it's also one of those interesting things, right? We often talk about evolution, and I think one of the biggest misconceptions, like you were talking about earlier, people think of evolution as being somehow guided towards a goal, when of course it's random. And people think of mutations as usually just being negative, but of course there are beneficial mutations. And there are just a lot of neutral mutations. Yeah, right. And psychopathy may not affect somebody's fitness.
Right. Well, most things are trade-offs, too.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
So you gain something, but you lose something, and you still muddle through, you know, to the end.
But, psychopaths might have, of course, as we learned from this neuropsychologist, it may have no bearing on their ability to find a mate, their ability to raise children, and it would just continue to persist kind of in the background.
Wait, what a thing to, like, for the public to know. Like, imagine if you, unfortunately, you know, get that label as a psychopath. Like, that's like, could you get a job? Would people want to be your friend? Like, that's serious
business.
Well,
see, but now we all know about it because of social media and the internet, right? I mean, seriously, because now these people are on the internet and they have a layer of protection, of anonymity, and, you know, even 1% of the people, like on Facebook or whatever, being psychopaths can really affect the culture there.
That's true. They are quite amplified. But you're right, Jay. Like, what if 23andMe had a psychopath measure?
Yeah.
Right? Yes. What if we knew kind of a pure genetic, at least a correlation, like some area of your genome, and we could carry that label around? Would that affect your ability to be insured? Would it affect your ability to have a job?
And it's a thing to be prejudiced against, you know, like it would be like you might be scared of that person. But I also would like the flip on that would be if you could get the test, then maybe you could be more willing to go to therapy and kind of deal with it.
I would hope so.
You know?
I will.
But again, there's. I do think that we have to be careful not to stigmatize or stereotype somebody with psychopathy because there's a little bit of crossover with, for example, autism or Asperger's, like spectrum disorders, with some difficulty with kind of interpersonal interaction, empathy, like learning about social cues. But many people with psychopathy are perfectly wonderful people. They just simply have difficulties kind of with theory of mind.
Okay.
Putting themselves in the shoes of another person and understanding their experience does not mean that they're necessarily, you know, bad people, that they're not nice people.
Well, we need new terminology. Psychopath has way too much baggage.
It's almost as bad as the word skeptic.
Or atheist.
Atheist is the big bang. Does it have a range unto itself?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And of course, you know, again, we talk about this a lot with psychological testing. It's always on a spectrum. It's always based on the rater. You know, somebody might be... There's no clear construct of psychopathy.
Yeah.
This is something that we invented to try and describe.
But it shows you how much more research we need to do, too.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's time for science or fiction.
All All right, who wants to play science or fiction?
Yay!
So each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake, and we have a theme.
Of course we do.
Of course we do. And the theme is fairly predictable. Whenever we go to a new place for the first time, I will often use that as the theme. So the theme is Cambridge. And for that reason, I'm not going to poll the audience until after these guys answer.
So why did you ask them who wants to play? They go,
You guys have to put your nickels down first. This is, shouldn't be hard.
He's going to poll you after we give our answers.
Yeah, after you give your answers, we'll give, let the audience tell you how wrong you are.
Right.
But beforehand, you're going to communicate with,
no,
with
no.
your eyes.
They're going to be like poker players, right? Not going to.
Where are my friends out there?
These aren't going to be hard. In fact, you may have heard these on our tour today.
If you were paying attention.
If you were paying attention. That's the key.
I had my headphones in. I was studying for...
All right, here we go. Number one, Cambridge University is associated with 90 Nobel Prizes, the highest in the UK, but third worldwide. Item number two, the wooden bridge was designed by Sir Isaac Newton and is the first to be based on mathematical principles. And item number three, Lord Byron was allowed to keep a bear as a pet at Trinity College because there was no specific rule against it. All right, Kara.
No!
You get to go first.
Was it Lord Byron with the bear? Somebody kept a bear as a pet. I did hear that. And I thought it was not because there was no specific rule against it, which would make sense, but because you couldn't have dogs. So it's like, oh, I have a bear. And I think that's like the, but that's probably apocryphal. That probably didn't actually happen.
That might be the key to this one, is figuring out which one is apocryphal.
Yeah, right? Wooden bridge. Didn't even see. No, I walked across the wooden bridge. Yeah, I think I walked across the wooden bridge. That's when I met up with you guys after interviewing Lord Martin. All right.
Star-Lord.
Star-Lord. Wooden bridge was designed by Sir Isaac Newton. I mean, I feel like it was probably someone else, right? Like, he couldn't have done everything on campus. The first to be based on mathematical principles? Oh, wait. No, that would be like, did Pythagoras ever design a bridge? Like, I was like, come on. Cambridge University is associated with 90 Nobel Prizes, the highest in the UK, but the third worldwide. This one's frustrating because there are three places where you could have just tweaked something.
Sure.
90 Nobel Prizes does not surprise me. Highest in the UK does not surprise me. Third worldwide does, but I don't know, maybe there's a bit of like an, is there like an Oslo bias or something? I don't know, so I'm going to go with the wooden bridge. I'm probably really wrong, but I feel like somebody previously used mathematical principles to design a bridge, because every bridge was designed with mathematical principles, or it would fall. Can't have been the first bridge ever built. No, yeah, I'm going to go with that one.
Okay.
Bridges
were just built.
Right? Mathematically.
All right. No help from the audience. Evan, go ahead.
Crumbs. I wish
I should have
paid closer attention.
Yes, you should have. I was paying attention to who was paying attention.
Now, we saw that bridge today, right?
Did you just say I was paying attention to who was paying attention? Which is why you guys are going last. Crap.
Sorry. Now, we saw that bridge today.
Yes.
And there, and our guides were talking about that bridge.
Yes.
And I specifically remember you wearing your headset.
And no, I was not wearing my headset. I heard just about everything. Except who designed it? Well, okay, I think the keeping a bear as a pet, no specific rule against it, that's totally reasonable. They wrote it in afterwards, probably along with a bunch of other animals. And then the 90 Nobel Prizes, I mean, really, how can you know that? You either just know it or you don't, and I don't think any of us really know that. But I guess I'll lean with Kara because I can't believe it's the first bridge to be based on mathematical principles. It just doesn't make sense. The Chinese never based a bridge on mathematical principles? How could it be the first?
He did write the book.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, but that doesn't necessarily mean
True.
Right, mm-hmm. in this case. So
we saw the book.
We saw the book.
Yeah. Oh, man, I wish the question was about the book. I could tell you about that. But I'll go with Kara, the Wooden Bridge one fiction.
Okay, Bob.
All right, so let's start with one. 90 Nobel Prizes, Cambridge, sure. Heist in the UK, sure. Third World Ride, yeah, I would think it'd be even better, but that one's not really ringing any bells, so that sounds good to me. Let's see, the Wooden Bridge. All right, so if you think about it, we got like, how many people today? 18 of us? Mm-hmm. 15? 18 yep. of us kind of spread out. So there were periods of time where I was kind of like in the middle or in the end, so I was missing some of the talk about the bridge, but I did hear two words, math bridge. So I'm like, all right. And then when you look at it, you're like, yeah, I could see that. But whether it was Newton or not, I don't know. But I'm going to say that one is science. And so the bear one, come on. I mean, it seems silly and made up, but that probably means that it's true, Steve. But what the hell, I'm going to say that one is fiction.
And Jay.
So the mathematical bridge, did you know that every piece of wood in that bridge is straight, even though it doesn't look it?
I heard that. Yeah. I heard that part.
You were really paying attention.
I was, Bob, yes.
I heard that part, too.
Did I hear enough what I heard, the two words?
I wasn't there, by the way.
Yeah, you were interviewing a lord. You have no excuse.
I missed it. No, I have every excuse.
Did you know that the bridge was taken apart and reassembled many times? Did you realize that?
No.
Did you know that? Yeah,
okay.
That happened
Science.
Also. Yeah.
Do you know that we also all missed the question about the London Bridge in London?
No, mm-hmm. I didn't.
So that one is right. That one is science.
Yes.
Now, the only thing that matters about the first one, about the 90 Nobel Prizes, is that Cambridge kicks Oxford's ass.
Cambridge. No one's
mine. Now, I agreed, because I did maybe read a little bit about, you know, England before I came here, because I'd like to like know about what I'm about to do. So I'm sure about a couple of things in there, but it's third worldwide. I'm not sure about that. So I'm going to put that one kind of like on the shelf just for a moment, because I'm going to get to the bear one. Now, we were given a tour today,
okay.
And the handsome man that gave us the tour specifically said that a bear was kept as a pet.
Crap.
I know.
Specifically said that a bear was kept as a pet. And I'm pretty damn sure he said Lord Byron. No, I am sure he said Lord Byron kept a bear pet. I'm 100% sure of that.
I'm sure he said that too.
And therefore.
But what I'm not sure about is how long he was able to keep it there, under what circumstances. Because any animals like that, they stink. They smell really bad. And they have to eat a lot, and they poop.
And they're dangerous.
And they're dangerous. So, like, I can't imagine that they let him just keep the bear there. Like, oh, we don't mind the smell, and we don't mind the fact that it's defecating all over the place.
But it's Lord Byron.
But he was a young Lord Byron if he was staying in the dormitory.
But it doesn't say how long. It just says he was allowed to, because there's no specific rule against it.
But if you follow my logic, Kara, I'm sorry, but two is, come on. I mean, it's the mathematical goddamn bridge. And the first one, like I said, Cambridge beats Oxford. Mm-hmm. So I have to go with number three as the fake. There's something right about that.
All right.
So we got two for the bridge and two for the bear. Let's poll the audience and see what they think.
Okay.
Now, I'll tell you that you did hear a lot of this information on the tour. The key is knowing what you heard was correct and what is apocryphal.
Yeah.
Aha.
Yeah. Right?
So no help.
Which is why I didn't change them after they mentioned my science or fiction items on the damn
board. Because you know how hard it is to retain facts.
Right. All right, so let's see what the audience is. We're going to do the single clap method. I'm going to drop my hand, and when my hand gets here, you're going to give me one clap at the exact same moment. So if you think that the Nobel Prize one is the fiction, clap. All right, three people from Oxford. All right, and if you think that the Wooden Bridge one is the fiction, clap. And if you think that the bear one is the fiction, clap.
Yeah.
Oh,
shit.
There's a pretty solid opinion.
We got the name wrong, Bob.
In the audience.
God damn it.
So, but let's go to number one, since you all agree on that one.
All right.
Cambridge University is associated with 90 Nobel Prizes, the highest in the UK, but third worldwide. Most of the people in this room think this one is science, and this one is...
science.
Don't do that.
Yes, they beat out Oxford. It was like 5 or something.
Yeah.
Number one is also in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
MIT.
Harvard.
Oh.
Harvard. MIT is in the top, is in like single digits as well. Number two, I think, is Columbia. And then Cambridge is third in the world, but one in the UK.
Sorry about that.
All right.
Steve, did you know that Cambridge owns a lot of land?
Yeah, I heard that. So, yeah, so Harvard got number one. All right. Let's go to number two. It was 101.
Close, it's tight. It's
yeah.
close.
It's, yeah, they're all, yeah. The wooden bridge was designed by Sir Isaac Newton and is the first to be based on mathematical principles. You guys might remember that during the tour, they referred consistently to this as the mathematical bridge.
Yes, now,
they didn't even refer to it as the wooden bridge. It was referred to as the mathematical bridge.
That's correct.
It is the first to be based on mathematical principles.
But Isaac Newton?
But Isaac Newton had nothing to do with it.
Oh, yeah, that's why I was right.
You got it right for the wrong reason.
I was missing it. In fact, Chris said all of that information during our tour.
He did. I remember. Oh, shit!
But I didn't think anyone else was paying attention to him at the time, so that's
See,
why
this is what this is why, like... Like, I'm a living example of lots of things.
Yeah.
But, like, the fact that he said Isaac Newton's name during the tour, all it did was pollute my memory. You shouldn't say, oh, and by the way, it's all bullshit. It wasn't him. And, you know, like, because as soon as I heard that name, like, that Isaac Newton, that mathematical bridge, and that's all my brain decided to keep.
Yep.
That's a heuristic, right?
Well, we actually talk about this in our book, about the fact that, remember, when you tell somebody a piece of information just to tell them that it's wrong, some of the time they remember the information, but not the fact that it was wrong, because truth status is stored separately from the fact itself in our memory, which is weird, right? We have, here's the memory, here's the source of the memory, and here's the truth status of the memory, and they're like independent memories in your head, and you have to sort of keep them together. And so saying, oh, yeah, people falsely say that Isaac Newton designed the mathematical bridge is not the way you want to communicate that information,
yes,
because
say the
people like Jay are going to remember Isaac Newton, mathematical bridge.
You know, I have talents of my own. Now, I want to say one more thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is an odd situation because we're usually not in a room full of people that really know the truth. So as I'm like talking everything through, I'm like scanning the audience and looking at people's faces. There wasn't one of you son of bitches. There wasn't a little nod or anything.
They followed my instructions very well.
We're used to following instructions, yes.
The third one, Lord Byron was allowed to keep a bear as a pet at Trinity College because there was no specific rule against it. That's the story. As far as I can tell, that's true. Carrie, you're right. It was revenge because they told him he couldn't keep his dog. So he said, oh, I can't keep my dog, can I? So he brought a bear, and there was no rule on the book against keeping bears. I'm sure eventually they sorted that out. But at least for a time, he like made an end run around the rules about not keeping dogs.
Man.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah.
Man.
Right.
So what about me and Bob then?
Yeah, you guys were wrong. But the thing is, it's interesting because you both were like wrong for the right reason. You guys are both right for the wrong reason because it is the mathematical.
I said I couldn't remember who, but you're right.
So, and the principle here, I like when there's a principle behind it where you could have figured it out. Things always attach themselves to famous people and usually incorrectly. Mm-hmm. So the idea that this was attached to Sir Isaac
Mark
Newton.
Mark Twain said everything. Right?
Isaac Newton did everything that happened around the time he was alive, right? That's just that's the way it's going to be. And almost all of it is not true. But the thing is, you can build a bridge without doing the maths, right? Without doing the engineering and calculating width and length.
Trial and error.
You could do a trial and error, just overbuild the crap out of it, right? So this was the first one where they actually did the calculations to know how to optimize the forces and everything.
I guess this is the first that was explicitly based on mathematics, but they're all implicitly based on mathematical principles,
I guess so. I mean, in that they don't fall down.
Yes.
But the design, not based on mathematical principles.
So they drew it, they knew it would work.
The universe is ruled by math, but it was not designed with mathematical principles explicitly. This one was, that's why it's called the mathematical bridge.
And is it, like, better?
Well, it's just, you know, they did the calculations.
It's really pretty.
You know, it is pretty.
It's an amazing
Do you know the Tacoma Narrows Bridge? You know that story?
Galloping
of the
Galloping Gertie.
Yeah.
That's the one where they didn't get the math right.
Yeah.
And this is an American bridge. Yeah, like they built it. This is what happened very, very quickly. They did do the engineering. They did the math. They calculated everything. Then they said, you know what? We got to make this wider. So they added a couple lanes to the bridge, and they didn't redo the math. And so what ended up happening was that there was a resonance between the oscillation frequencies. And so the first storm that came by started to oscillate and oscillate until then it completely collapsed.
Look at the footage on YouTube. It's amazing.
It's amazing. Tacoma Narrows Bridge, right.
Galloping Gertie also.
That was
I love the guy that runs on the bridge. As the bridge is doing this, he runs on the bridge to save a dog.
Well, he runs off, then he runs back on to get his dog, and then comes back off again. Right.
Thanks for that extra detail.
Yeah. Well, he did go back. It's important. He was on the middle of the bridge and he like fled. Then he's like, shit, I left my dog on the bridge and we went back together.
He saved his dog.
Steve does this to all of us.
This has been the entire trip.
Yeah.
A weekend.
I'm just editing in real time. Okay, Evan, do you have a quote for us to close out the show?
I do have a quote to close out the show. Man is slightly nearer to the atom than to the star. From his central position, man can survey the grandest works of nature with the astronomer, or the minutest work with the physicist. Knowledge of the stars leads through the atom, and important knowledge of the atom has been reached through the stars. Mm-hmm. Sir Arthur Stanley Eddington,
nice.
Cambridge alumnus.
Very appropriate. And thank you all for joining us for the show.
You.
Thank you all for joining me as always.
Thank you, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.